Okay. I think we're in business.
Sweet.
How's it going?
Good. Good.
So, welcome back to episode 2 of Thing That Doesn't Have a Title. It's on the to-do list, I swear.
We'll get there.
Yeah, you know. We're going to have a backlog first. I'm Alex Junite. That's Ben Wick.
Hey!
Yeah. I wanted to start today's episode with what I feel like is probably going to be a regular feature, given my track record, which is shit I meant to say last time. And it's not going to be as big a feature as I wanted it to be because I left my note sheet at work. But the one thing that I did remember wanting to look up was the name of the person who directed the Calamity Song music video that I was talking about last time. And it turns out that that is actually co-creator of Parks and Rec and creator of The Good Place, Michael Schur. Mm-hmm. So, that's that correction. Yeah,
The Good Place was very nearly my recommendation for things this week, last week, and then I chickened out and went with Nova.
It was very nearly mine this week. So, let's just call it a bonus recommendation. Go watch it. It's interesting. It's a sitcom that handles an ongoing plot in a way that I don't think I've ever seen before. We were kind of talking about that on the way over here.
Yeah.
So. All right. Any other front-end business? Anything going on?
No. Let's jump in. Okay. The topic this week is things that you like by someone or in something that you don't like, or vice versa. Sort of like what's the diamond in the rough, or what's the one, you know, really bad thing by that person you just adore.
The mud puddle you step in, or,
yeah,
you know, outliers of some kind.
Right.
Okay. Well, you went first last week, so I'm going to go first this time.
Start us off.
And I'm going to start off with one. Like, I thought about it, and, like, 3 seemed like a good number to kind of go for, so that's what I have. And I don't like being a negative Nancy, so I kind of wanted to do, like, these are things I like by people I otherwise maybe kind of don't. But, for diversity's sake, I did include one where it's, like, this is something that I'm not quite as big a fan of, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to kind of soften it a little bit, because it's not something I hate. It's just not something that I like as much as everybody else seemed to. Let's put it that way. And so, okay, so what I'm talking about basically is The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, the most recent Zelda game.
Mm.
So there's a lot that I do like about it. The open world aspect of it is really interesting. It's a huge world. It takes, like, hours to get across. It's beautifully rendered. I think they did some really interesting things with storytelling in this one, with the, like, memories that you have to go around and recover. Like, there's a lot working for it, but it has a few points that I really kind of don't like, and that's kind of what's sticking in memory when I think about playing it. And sort of the main quibbles that I have are, well, alright, I'm going to talk about 2 of them, because there's 2 that I can think of specifically. One is, the way weapons and equipment are handled in this game is very different than in previous Zelda titles. So, like, in most Zelda games, like, you have your sword, and that's your sword for the whole game. That's what it is. And, like, I think there's a couple of them where you can, like, upgrade it to the Master Sword at some point where it gets a little bit fancier, but basically it's just, that's what it is. And then you get a bunch of other tools that help you do things, but Breath of the Wild, that's not how it works. In Breath of the Wild, you basically have to pick up weapons that enemies drop. So, like, if you don't have any weapons, you find a stick. You grab that stick, you bash some, like, goblin creatures over the head with it, steal their spear, use that to, like, bash some bigger dudes, get their swords, etc., etc. But after a certain number of hits, the item will break.
Okay.
And in some respects, I think this is part of the kind of whole open world concept that they were doing, because it kind of makes it such that you can go kind of anywhere in the world and do anything you want to do in any order you want to do without it necessarily depending on equipment. But what ended up happening for me, like, a lot of the time, is, like, as I was playing it, I would find myself, like, not wanting to use certain weapons because it's like, oh, well, that's, like, a slightly better one, and, like, it's gonna break, and maybe I'll need a better one later. So, like, I get this whole, like, backstock of weapons that I'm not using.
Mm-hmm.
It made it, like, hard to get attached to anything because, like, you just know it's gonna break if you do anything with it, so... It just sort of, I don't know, it took the wind out of the sails a little bit for me. And I think the idea is interesting. Like, I think there's a lot you could potentially do with that, but I don't know if it was executed the way that I would have liked to have seen. But the main quibble that I have with it is the shrine system. Okay, so... You've never played a Zelda game, right?
I have not.
Okay. Like, Zelda games are kind of known for their puzzles.
Right.
Like, that's the thing. In your standard Zelda game, and there are other games that deviate a little bit from this formula, I think. I haven't played all of them. I have played a lot of them, but, like, especially some of the handheld ones, I haven't had a chance to do. But in all the ones that I have played thus far, those puzzles are kind of distributed mostly in dungeons. Like, there's a few, like, in-between dungeons and things like that, and then there's also, like, things that you stumble on in the world that you have to, like, figure out how to deal with. In Zelda Breath of the Wild, it's a little bit different. There is this, basically the system works, like, there are these things called shrines. There's a ridiculous number of them. I want to say it's like 120 or so, spread out throughout the world. And some of them you just kind of have to, like, find and you can get right into them. Some of them you have to do certain things to, like, make them appear. There's one, the one that I remember of that example specifically is the game has a day-night cycle, and, like, periodically within that cycle, like, a blood moon will happen.
Okay.
Where, like, monsters become a little bit tougher and whatever for, like, a certain period. And there's one shrine that, like, you have to basically stand naked on it during a blood moon to get it to appear. And that's kind of fun. But then within each shrine... It's like a little kind of mini dungeon. It's a puzzle unto itself. So some of them are just like, you know, figure out how to, like, get up to this one particular ledge using the stuff in this room. But they vary a lot. Like, there's another one that I remember, the one that gave me a bit of trouble, actually, where you're on a ledge and there's a big metal ball on the ledge with you, and then on the far off ledge there's, like, basically a hoop, and you have to kind of, like, use your, like, time freezy power and hit it with a hammer a bunch of times to, like, build up momentum in a certain way. And it's kind of like playing golf. Like, you have to get it into that hoop to open the door near you and go through into the thing. The final room. And in the final room of each shrine, there's an old guy who says, like, a rote thing. Basically, like, hey, you're a hero. You did some cool shit. Here's an orb. And then you trade those orbs for... heart containers or more stamina, or that's how you upgrade, basically.
Okay.
What kind of got to me about that was by the time you've done half of them, like, that's 60 shrines, and they all look the same, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it becomes a very flat, very rote exercise. And this is not an entirely new problem. Like, other Zelda games have dealt with this, famously, like, the second half of The Wind Waker, which is the one that's on, like, a giant ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the second half of that is basically just a really elaborate fetch quest that's, like, very rote and kind of dull. So like that kind of like repetitive problem has occurred before, but like when these puzzles, the puzzles themselves are typically brilliant. Like they're occasionally maddening in terms of like, I know this should work, but it's not. Oh right, I have to go around and do this thing. Kind of okay, got it. It's, you know,
mm-hmm.
a good Zelda puzzle is like a Mensa test. But when they're distributed in dungeons, there's a kind of a more holistic feel to them. Like, there's an example that I'm thinking, well, there's a couple examples. I mean, like, famously, there's the water temple in Ocarina of Time, where, like, in addition to, like, the puzzles within individual rooms, there's also the puzzle of the temple itself, where you can, like, adjust the water levels, like, basically flood it or drain it.
Mm-hmm.
To unlock or lock certain areas, and like you have to like keep doing that and moving it around to like make it through the path of the dungeon. There's one like in the original Game Boy one, Link's Awakening, where you're in a giant tower and the boss is up on the top floor of the tower, and in order to get there you have to like cart this like big metal ball around through different rooms in the dungeon and get past all the smaller puzzles so that you can like bash in these columns with it, knock down the top floor, and get up there. It just... But, like, not having that, having, like, kind of each puzzle separated as its own little room just kind of takes a lot of the wind out of it, I suppose, and makes it feel very exhausting. And so, like, I finished the game. I really like the story. I really like the dungeons that do exist in the game, because there are a couple in the form of, like, these giant mechanical beasts. There's four of them, and then the final dungeon, which is Hyrule Castle itself, where you have to, like, assault the castle and defeat Ganon, and, like, that dungeon in particular is awesome. But since you spend so much of the game, like, doing the shrine things, it felt like a slog to get there in a way that, in my opinion, the best Zelda games do not. So, that's my spiel on that one.
Right. I'm gonna do some free association with the words here. I know you mentioned Wind Waker and things being taken out of, like, the wind being taken out of your sails. I'm gonna jump into a little bit that I would like to talk about with the book series The Kingkiller Chronicles,
okay.
Which features the name of the wind. We made the loop work. I did it. So basically, if you're unfamiliar, Patrick Rothfuss is writing a series of books called The Kingkiller Chronicles. In 2007, we got The Name of the Wind. It took him 9 years to write. It is the finest fantasy book that I have ever read.
Yeah, those 9 years show.
I mean, it's clear that what he's doing is honing each individual scene into something that has to exist for the book to function. It's about a 700-page book, but it reads so quickly because everything just tumbles into the next circumstance.
Yeah.
The sequel came out 4 years later. It's called The Wise Man's Fear. It's a 1,000-page book that took him 4 years to write. So, I mean, he's speeding up with it, but...
He was.
Technically in the series, but not part of the trilogy that makes up the Kingkiller Chronicles, was The Slow Regard of Silent Things. Came out in 2014.
Still one of my favorite book titles ever.
It is an amazing title, and it's an exploration of a character who has become so attuned to the energy around her that she can sense the desires of inanimate objects. If that sounds kind of bonkers, it absolutely is, and the
yes.
whole book reflects that. I am absolutely in love with the way that Rothfuss writes, and with the way that... I mean, I'm serious. Like, you spend 50 pages at the beginning of the first book talking about, like, oh, well, I was a traveling bard, and that becomes important because he becomes a musician who meets a traveling tinkerer, and that inspires in him a lifelong respect of magic and knowledge, and so the next time that he has the ability, he heads off to a magical university, but there's so many stops he has to make before it, and it's just...
Just as a quick side note, like, you mentioned he's a musician, and, like, I love the way that music is treated in those novels.
It's
like,
loving and respectful and full of awe.
Yeah.
He writes it so beautifully, just the appreciation of music that is evident in the very feel of the writing is fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, you can sort of feel the melodies that he's talking about, even though you're just reading the words on the page. Now, the reason I'm talking about this in the Outliers episode is there is one scene, an extended scene, like several chapters, that exist in The Wise Man's Fear, the second book, which I think depart from the everything is necessary and everything is compelling formula.
Okay.
And that is the 59 pages over which we have to read about the main characters dabbling with Felurian, a goddess of sexuality and fertility. Now, basically, there's only two notable plot events that occur over this entire 60-page span.
That we know of.
I'm counting things that I'm assuming become important later on. I'm not going to get into them too intensely because that would be potential spoilers, but believe me when I say you can't stumble through a couple of pages in this book series without something monumental happening, and that completely slows to a stop.
The pace does really slow down.
For the Felurian chapter. I can understand that it is a coming of maturity section. Here's someone who has had, like, the main character, Quoth, is someone who has never had, like, a real relationship necessarily, romantically. He is just head over heels in love with someone who, because of the book's rhythm, he's never able to actually, like, make that relationship happen.
Yeah, they kind of pass in the night a lot.
Yeah, I mean, and they get excruciatingly close. You feel their mutual, like, desire and how close they are to actually becoming together, and it never happens.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell that it's not going to happen. This isn't a spoiler. And so Felurian represents for him, I'm going to go off. I'm going to, like, actually, like, I'm not just going to sleep with some women. I'm going to sleep with the goddess of sex.
Which is kind of the nature of this character. Like, he's very much a go big or go home kind of guy.
Yeah, he's a legend in literally everything he does, because that's who he is. He's Quoth the King Killer.
That's something I love about the books. I know I keep, like, going off on tangents during your thing.
No, you're,
like,
fine.
I love the mythologized nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's telling this story, and you don't entirely know how much you can trust it, because you know that he is a spinner of stories.
Right.
Like,
yeah, the whole thing is set up with this framing device of the first book is one day of Quoth telling his life story to a couple of people. The second book is the second day of 3 days of him sitting and telling his life story up to this point. Everything that happens to him is from the "this is what happened to me" perspective, and he openly admits, like, there's whole conversations that happen outside of the story where the characters he's telling the story to go, for real, though. There's no way that's true. He's like, hey, I'm telling the story here, all right?
Yeah.
You're coming to me for my story. I'm telling you my story.
He also does things a couple of times, especially in book two, where he's like, a whole bunch of cool stuff happened there, but I'm not going to talk about that.
Yeah, I'm thinking specifically of the ship.
Yeah,
like,
the journey to the
city. I was on a ship for 3 months. We fought off pirates. We almost drowned. The ship went down, but all that's a story for another time, because then I got there.
God damn it. All
right. So I I'm conceding here. There's the like the coming of age tale. There's definitely some stuff that is set up for some. It appears to be some sort of arch enemy in what will be the final book of the trilogy.
You're talking about the thing in the tree, I take it.
Yes, the Cthir.
Yeah.
However that's pronounced. But one of the things that's really difficult about it is this Felurian section comes hot on the tails of this, like, 100-page quest, at least, to track down this enemy who's been ravaging the country. It's literally the reason that the second book's, like, main plot exists. And then the Felurian happens, and then right afterwards he goes off and joins the Adem Society, which is quite possibly the most fascinating societies I've ever encountered in a fiction world. Yeah,
like every time I think of the Adem, I just think of, like, they don't believe in fatherhood.
Yeah, they don't believe in fatherhood. They only communicate, really, through the most elaborate system of body language that anyone has ever devised, to the point where, like, by the time that you're done with the Adem chapters, they'll say something like, oh, he placed two forefingers on the inside of his elbow, and you're like, oh, contempt and disgust! Like, you actually get into the world. Like, it's just such a jarring experience to exist in this nether region for a while,
and, like,
for no...
You see it a lot throughout, like, both books, but, like, the Adem Society, for me, was where it really hit home of the, like, this is really interesting, and in, like, a really original way.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of, like, fantasy stories, like, okay, this culture is, like, clearly an analog of this real world culture, or, like, these two real world cultures mashed together, and, like, this doesn't feel like that. Like, there are a couple familiar elements in it, but it feels like a very whole, organic thing, which is really cool.
It does, and that's, I mean, it's the sense you get through the whole book about pretty much everything he writes about, which is why I mean, one of the first things I thought of when we talked about the outliers were that portion is, the Felurian chapters aren't poorly written by any means. They just don't exist in the same world as the rest of the book, and they don't carry the same purpose that every other passage in the rest of the books do. It's everyone who I've ever spoken to about the book comes back and says, man, it was such a good book. What was with the Felurian part?
Well,
and I mean, like, it's without fail.
Yeah, and I get that. I'm waiting for the third book just to see, like, first of all, what was the other major plot point? Because I remember, like, it's meeting the thing in the tree.
There's that, and then I'm also counting the idea that he is going to use his, like, he has that cloak now.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a literal shadow cloak. Like, it doesn't really come too much into use in the second book, but it certainly will in the third.
Yeah, and, like, that's... I'm kind of reserving judgment on that one just until the third book happens, because, like, it's not just that. It's, like, I don't know what he's doing with, like, the whole Fae world in general.
Right.
Like, I don't know if that's the only, like, little thing that we're going to get of it, or if that's going to become more of a deal in day three.
I mean, given Bast, it's almost certain that we're going to see more of the Fae world.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily saying there's nothing that can change my mind on it, but as it exists now, it's more than a bit off-putting.
Okay.
In a book that is otherwise so compelling that you're turning pages almost before you're done reading the page.
Yeah, it goes very quickly.
So yeah, that's my first entry.
Okay. All right, entry number two. I'm kind of... all right, which one do I want to do first? I think I want to do a movie next. I kind of, like, made a conscious effort to choose different media. Like, that's...
Same here.
...a thing that I'm going to try and do in this, because, like, I want to have a sort of a broad focus. So I picked a movie by a director who... has a certain reputation for a reason. And the name of that guy is Paul W.S. Anderson, who has directed some very interesting films, including, and I had a list, but it was written down on a piece of paper I don't have, so I'm going to look it up real quick on this computer. But I know, like, one of them was the first Mortal Kombat movie from, like, 95 or whenever that came out. He did the at least a couple, maybe all, of, like, the Resident Evil series. Like, those movies. Let's see, what else we got? Alien vs. Predator. Those are the 2011 Three Musketeers, apparently. Those are the ones that I recognize, except for the one that I'm going to talk about, which is Event Horizon. Which is a movie that, like, I don't know if I'd say that it's, you know, technically good, but it's interesting. It does, like, some fun... Have you seen it?
I haven't.
Okay. So the premise of it is, it's the future, space travel is a thing, whatever. They created this spaceship that has, and you'll have to bear with me because it's been a little while, but something like, some kind of like super warp drive or something where it like fucks with space and uses that to travel and whatever, and it's like a big deal. And the first time they use it, like something goes wrong and it never shows up where it's supposed to. It just disappears.
Okay.
And then a whole bunch of time passes, and all of a sudden, like, out on the edge of the solar system, it shows up again. And so they send out a crew, including Sam Neill. And let's see, who else is in this? Anybody? Lawrence Fishburne.
Oh.
Kathleen Quinlan's in here. Jolie Richardson. Sean Pertwee, which is a name that I know, but I don't know why. Anyway, so they send out a crew to, like, go and investigate it. And essentially the premise is, like, it went somewhere outside the universe that is, if not literally, very much like hell.
Okay.
And came back. And it's basically like a haunted house movie in space, on this ship, but it has this like really kind of like dark, grimy industrial design, and like the hell scenes, like the little flashes that you get of that are really fucking terrifying. Sam Neill is pretty great in it. It's like a trashy, silly horror movie, but like something about it just clicks and just works. And it's like, if you're watching it late at night, I think it's on Netflix, it at least used to be, like it's actually kind of unsettling. And in a way that's like, yeah, I'm laughing at how stupid that looks, but that's fucked up though. Shit. In a way that, like, I think a lot of his other work kind of maybe strives for, but doesn't quite get there with. So, I don't have as much to say about that one, but sure. That's my entry for number two.
Alright. I'm gonna jump from movies to television. This one is actually a nested outlier within an outlier. Mm. So, I am a big fan of the television show Community.
Okay.
If you're not familiar with Community, they did 3 seasons of a show about a community college and the 7 people in a study group. Then the showrunner got kicked off of the show, and they made a terrible 4th season. That's the first outlier. Then, because it was so bad, they brought back the showrunner. Dan Harmon is the person in question. and he made a fifth season. Then NBC decided that they weren't going to make the show anymore, but Yahoo Screen decided they would make another season. So they made another season on Yahoo Screen with a much altered cast. By much altered, I mean, like, they took, like, half of the people out of the cast and...
It's 6 seasons total?
Replaced it. 6 seasons total. Okay.
I've seen one episode, and it's the one you showed me, and I like that.
Yes, I showed Alex the, I believe it's called something to the extent of Introduction to Chaos Theory. People know it as the Parallel Universe episode, where... everybody is in Troy and Abed's new apartment, and they roll a die to see who goes to pick up the pizza when the pizza arrives. And then each die roll results in a different universe. So they show you what happens with each of the 7 characters going to get the pizza. It's very conceptual and very bizarre, but each of the stories tells its own complete, like, emotional resolution story, which is all about the... I mean, that's thanks to the way that Dan Harmon writes. He developed this circle of each narrative has to follow a, like, step one, establish your protagonist. Step two, what's wrong in their life. Step three, they enter the threshold of a new world. What does it look like? Step four, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the way around until they've become a master of both worlds and return to where they were. So... a lot of that goes out the window with season 4. The first 3 episodes of Community are, for me, inarguably brilliant, creative, and incredibly obsessed in a loving but still parodying way with pop culture at large. This is why people don't refer to the show's episodes by their titles, but instead as the first paintball episode or like the second Halloween episode, stuff like that.
Okay.
So, as I said, the 4th season doesn't have Dan Harmon. It is 13 episodes long, just like all of the seasons, and only 2 of those episodes are watchable, and that's where these second level of outliers come in.
Okay.
As an example of how bad the 4th season is, there's a puppet episode, which is kind of in line with how Community sets itself up. Let's like, they did a claymation episode while Dan Harmon was on board. So this one was going to be a puppet episode. Well, the puppet episode...
like, there are about 5 puppets in this room right now. So, like, when you say puppets, my ears perk up a little bit.
Right. So, the way that this works is all of the characters are so ashamed of something that happened that they won't talk about that they're given puppets to talk through their issues with.
Okay.
The puppets get on a hot air balloon. It's also, by the way, a musical episode.
Oh boy, doubling up.
The puppets get on a hot air balloon. The hot air balloon takes them out to a forest. Hot air balloon comes down. They eat some hallucinogenic berries with Jason Alexander. And then they sit around a campfire and sing songs about their most tragic and screwed up of secrets.
Okay. That sounds like a lot.
It is a lot, and unfortunately it doesn't really add up.
Okay.
At one point, one of the characters makes a Lost reference, which is so bad that they actually had to explain that it was a Lost reference with the next line of dialogue, but in a way where they were like, oh no, we're being clever by pointing out that we're making a reference, which makes it that much more painful.
Mm.
Like, that's the average caliber of humor that's going on throughout this.
Okay. That sounds like a like a Big Bang Theory level
yeah,
of humor.
It's especially disappointing.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's like the general caliber. I mean, the way that Dan Harmon described the 4th season in terms of, like, quality was, the season finale was a fucking Matrix parody in 2013. Who thought in 2013 we wanted a Matrix parody?
Oh, God.
It might have been even more recent than that.
I'm just trying to, like, based on what little I do know about the show, I'm just trying to conceptualize what that would look like.
Well, actually, you saw the episode where the evil timeline comes in.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, the one episode I show you, like, they, at the end, all, like, the terrible timeline where, like, Jeff loses an arm and, like...
Okay, I do remember someone losing an arm.
Yeah, like, that, all that, that timeline in the fourth season tries to overtake the good timeline, and they end up matrixing each other somehow.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not good. Don't think too much about it.
Done.
But, there are two good episodes. I'm not going to say that they uphold the quality of the the Harmon season episodes, but they are good enough that, like, I could watch them. I watched them again the other day, and they were actually good enough that I laughed. So I'll give them that. So I just stared painfully and wistfully at the television when I watched the puppet episode again. The second episode of the fourth season is called Paranormal Parentage. It is the fourth Halloween episode. It is honestly pretty good. It includes a couple decent jokes about like Halloween costumes, which is like a recurring bit. Like Troy and Abed dress up as Calvin and Hobbes, and that's kind of charming, I suppose. Hooray. Mm-hmm. But they, like, the...
I bet Bill Watterson loved that.
Oh, yeah, he was just rolling both directions in his grave, corkscrewing away.
I don't think he's dead.
Yeah, I mean, preemptively.
His future grave.
Yeah.
He's like, you know what, I'm gonna roll in my grave about that later.
There's nothing specifically that I can say about the Halloween episode to describe it as funny, aside from... one of the characters who's, like established as an old racist has a...
Chevy Chase.
Yeah. Chevy Chase's character has a safe room, which he got installed on the day that Do the Right Thing aired in theaters. Like... that's pretty good. Like, I will give it that.
Oh, God.
The other good episode, I think, was mostly tolerable because... It was directed by Jay Chandrasekhar of the Broken Lizard team. He is, if you're unfamiliar with that, he's in Super Troopers. He's one of the guys from that team.
Okay. I was like, that name sounds familiar.
He plays Ramathorn.
I just got that movie at Goodwill the other day.
Uh-huh. I mean, it's got the reputation it has for a reason. Yeah. It's thoroughly entertaining. It's the episode that he directs is called Advanced Documentary Filmmaking, and it's another one of the documentary episodes. This one is about whether or not Changnesia is real. The fact that I have to say Changnesia unironically right now hurts me a little bit, but there's a character named Chang who likes to pun on his own name, and he gets amnesia.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is one of those things where it's like I'm trying to think of like a response to that, and I just hit in a wall.
You don't need one. The ultimate bottom line that I have here is these two episodes they're good, they're pretty good. I enjoyed them. I'm not coming down too hard on all of season four, but in general, it is the season constantly makes jokes making fun of the show itself, but not in like a self-conscious. Like, self-referential, oh, I'm so ridiculous, the things that I do. But in a way where, like, because it's being run by a different team, it's like they're making fun of the three seasons that came before it. Mm. Like, they're saying, I can't believe that we have to make this show instead of some show that we came up with.
I see.
Like, at one point in the Halloween episode, one of the characters goes, I remember when this show used to be about community college. Which... It's like, well, you're running the show now. You could make it about community college again if you wanted. And, like, since when has a show stuck to exactly what it does in its first season?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Sorry, I'm thinking about the end of How I Met Your Mother and getting mad again. But anyway.
Oof.
Not gonna go there.
Yeah, let's not go there. that's my second entry is... Community is great. Season 4 is not. There's a couple episodes that are decent. Watch those and just move on. If you're powering through the whole show, just Paranormal Parentage, Advanced Documentary Filmmaking, Pretend the Rest Didn't Happen.
I'm a Simpsons fan. I know that dynamic. Like, nope. Not going to talk about that. Speaking of not talking about that, it's just a little bit. There. Okay. Okay. So, my third thing that I have saved for third, because it was the thing that, like, occurred to me when this show idea got floated.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is kind of the example of this that I go to. And that is Panic at the Disco's second album, Pretty Odd.
Oh.
Which came out in a year. Again, don't have my note sheet right now, so I'm cheating. I want to say, like, 2008. Yes, they are a band that has people in it. That's great. Discography. 2008. Yes, nailed it. Okay. So, their first album, which has a title, A Fever You Can't Sweat Out, was kind of lumped in with the music that... I'm trying, the best way I can think of to describe it is that if I were still in high school at the time, all of the people that I hated in high school would have been big fans of it. Like, it was, and that's, like, being a little cruel to it, I suppose, because, like, I've gone back and I've kind of, like, explored a lot of, like, the My Chemical Romance and the Fall Out Boy, and, like, a lot of it is not for me, but there's some stuff to like there. But Panic... It's first record, I can't do it. I just can't. Like, there's a song on it called, like, Lying is the Most Fun a Girl Can Have Without Taking Her Clothes Off, or something to that effect. And that just... the distaste in my mouth saying that title aloud kind of captures my feeling about the whole record. It's just... ugh. Like, a young male... obnoxiousness in, like, a way that is all, like, sharp, angular sounds, but, like, not in an interesting way. It's... I can't do it. Like, I can't even really describe it, because I don't want to listen to it to describe it. You know what I'm saying? But somewhere in between the release of that record in 2005 and the release of their second record, Pretty Odd, in 2008... the guitarist and, like, one of the main songwriters, Ryan Ross, basically, like, discovered the Beatles.
Wow, what a pioneer.
Well, okay, yes.
Sorry.
No, fair enough, it's a fair criticism, like, but the effect that this had is that the second album sounds very, very different. Like, really just kind of dove into that whole, like, 60s pop thing, and, like, was still kind of doing that, like, mid-2000s, I don't know, is it emo? I don't even know what qualifies as that, really.
Yeah, I think everybody defines it differently.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things. But, whatever that genre is, like, still kind of doing that, but then, like, throwing in a trombone solo, and, like, here's a weird sort of country song, and, like, it is, it's very, I mean, they were pretty young when they recorded it, and it is very adolescent in a lot of ways, but it's appealingly so in a way that is a very dramatic shift. Like, if you're looking for kind of songs on it to sort of sample what I'm talking about, I think, like, actually the last two are my personal favorites, which are called, one of them is Mad as Rabbits, and the other one is From a Mountain in the Middle of the Cabins. And it's just, it's a very different kind of pop that, see, this is, like, it's hard to talk about music without playing it, And so there's things I can point to, like, oh, you hear that bit? Oh, you hear this bit? But,
well, we can edit that stuff in, right?
I don't know, like, licensing issues and stuff. Right. But I think, I don't know how much you're allowed to use without having to, like...
It's, like, less than 5 seconds, I think.
Is it? Damn, that's not...
It's for sampling, yeah, at least.
That's not a lot. But I think, like, what really interested me the most about it was not necessarily specifically the sound of it itself, but the fact that they took that shift, that they were willing to make, like, a right turn in their music. And, like, that impressed me. And then I think Ryan Ross left the band shortly thereafter, and they kind of went back to what they were doing before, and I haven't really given their releases after that much thought or consideration, because, like, I listened to the one immediately following that and was like, what I liked about this is gone. So it's kind of an oddity, a pretty oddity. But yeah, that's my spiel on that.
Right. My final example is also from the world of music. I want to talk about Weird Al.
Oh.
Weird Al is something akin to a religious figure for me.
Stained glass window.
Oh, if I could afford one. I mean, I do have a limited edition lithograph of him right next to my computer. So I can look at him riding a horse of the apocalypse. I'm sorry, the Owlpocalypse.
Ah, naturally.
So when I say that he's like a religious figure for me, I mean, I have memorized all but one of his songs over his, I believe, 14-album career.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Which started back in 1983.
Yeah.
First, let's talk a little bit about his first album. It was just called Weird Al Yankovic, self-titled album. It has some great parodies, like My Bologna, Another One Rides the Bus, are always known as his first couple.
Hmm.
Also, Stop Dragging My Car Around. It was always a favorite of mine.
I don't know if I know that one.
It's a parody of Tom Petty's Stop Dragging My Heart Around.
And Stevie Nicks, I think?
Yeah. Yeah. And then he also, I mean, like, on every album he's ever done, it's half parodies, half original music. He's got some amazing original music on this first album. Songs like Got a Boogie, which literally the joke is he says Got a Boogie, like, in a boo doo 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 doo, got a boogie. Yeah, and then eventually the song reveals that he's gonna say Got a Boogie on my finger and I can't shake it off. Oh! And just keeps going. There's also the beautiful song Mr. Frump in the Iron Lung, which is as dark as it sounds like it would be. it's honestly, for a first album, incredibly strong, immediately cemented what he was going to do. And then there's this song, it's the very first song on the album, it's called Ricky. It's a parody of the song Mickey. They're like, hey, Mickey, you so fine, you so fine. Yeah.
Oh, I am familiar.
So Ricky was actually the first comedy video on MTV of all time. He's got that down. And everything about Ricky should be great. He's singing about I Love Lucy, which, I mean, is pretty timeless, I think. Like, yeah. Most people who have never even seen the show, or at least familiar with, like, the characters and the concept of the show, the fact that it existed, at least.
Yeah.
For the voice of Lucy, he got Tress McNeil of The Simpsons, Futurama, Animaniacs, Rugrats.
Yeah. Every cartoon you like.
Yeah. She's probably the main female character. And if for the people who are just like, oh, I like Futurama, she's Leela. Okay? Like, you like her.
Is she Leela? No, because Katie Seagal is Leela.
Oh, is she?
Yeah.
Never mind. We'll edit that part out.
I think she's, like, most of the other female characters.
Yeah, every other character in the cast. And I have to say, Weird Al's impression of Desi Arnaz is, like, really spot on. Tress MacNeille's impression of Lucy is, like, right on. But the problem is, it's, Mickey is an obnoxious song.
Oh my god.
It's super fucking obnoxious.
Yes.
It gets more obnoxious when you add an I Love Lucy impression to it.
I can only imagine.
And when a lot of the jokes in the song are references to the show, there's not, like, a lot of humor in the first place. It's literally just like, hey, you've seen I Love Lucy, right?
Or have you?
Right.
You could say it has some splaining to do.
It that's in the song.
Of course it is.
So for me, it comes down to it's kind of too obnoxious to be funny, and it's too obnoxious to be an enjoyable song. So it ends up just being this weird love letter to I Love Lucy that feels a heck of a lot longer than the 2.5 minutes that it is.
As does Mickey.
Yeah. For me, it starts the album off on the wrong foot. It proves that the quality of the voice of the singer really does matter. Because as solid impressions as they are, it does not actually add up to, like, an enjoyable song. And it pains me to say this. Really, it does. I listened to the whole song in preparation for doing this. And I was like, you know, if I heard this, I would not think this guy is going to have platinum records mm-hmm. in more decades than any other recording artist in history, which Weird Al does.
Yeah, he's hit 4 now.
Yeah, he's the only person who's ever gone that far. And honestly, like, all he has to do is release one in 2020 and he'll set a record that no one will ever beat.
Didn't he say he wasn't going to, like, do albums anymore?
I don't know about that.
Yeah. That's true. Artists have said that and then been like, actually, never mind.
But yeah, oh my god, it's hard for me to explain how much I care about Weird Al. It really, truly is.
When did Mandatory Fun come out? That was the last one, right?
Mandatory Fun came out, I want to say, 1.5, 2 years ago. Okay. So like 2016.
That sounds about right.
For listeners. Before that was Alpocalypse. Before that was, I believe, Straight Outta Linwood.
Okay.
Straight Outta Linwood is the last album he made that I think is, like, phenomenal. I think the last two... again, it might just be me getting older and, like, I don't listen to the music that he parodies anymore.
Yeah, there is that.
I enjoy the parodies. I just pretend they're original music. And remind myself, like, oh yeah, that awkward forced rhyme was so that he could rhyme with the actual song. If you're not a fan of Weird Al, and maybe you're like familiar with the concept of Weird Al, but you're not
into polka.
Not into the polka. I would say check out some of his original music. Mr. Frump and the Iron Lung is a really funny song from his first album. It's genuinely, like, clever and dark, and it showed he was an experiment a lot. Another good song from that album, I'll Be Mellow When I'm Dead. But then, like, to cherry pick a couple others, try out Everything You Know Is Wrong from Bad Hair Day. I believe that was, like, 1994-ish?
Somewhere around there. Mid-90s. Because that was the one where he has, like, the crazy Coolio hair.
Yeah, because he did the parody of Gangster's Paradise. Amish Paradise. Yeah. Also, Hardware Store is, like, a really out-there, weird song. That one's from Poodle Hat, 2003.
What does the title even mean?
He wears his pet poodle on his head on the subway. It's a poodle hat.
Bray a poodle on my noodle, it shall rest. Which is a Simpsons joke, by the way.
Between me having Weird Al covered and you having Simpsons covered, we've got, like, the goofy parody pop culture stuff down.
From the 90s, anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's It pains me to pick Weird Al as having an outlier, but it's true.
Well, it makes sense. Like, it's something that you love, so if there's a part of it that doesn't work, it'll stand out.
It does. It does stand out. You know, it was funny, too. I was talking to my sister before the podcast, and she's like, every time that we're going to record, she's like, oh my gosh, what are your examples going to be? And so I told her, and she's like, oh my god, Ricky's so bad! I remember you'd skip it every time! And I'm like, yeah, like, even as like a 13-year-old, I was like, I can't tolerate this. I'm sorry, this is going to have to be skipped.
Yeah. Like, I don't know Ricky, but I'm just thinking of Mickey, and...
I'll play it for you when we're done recording.
Okay.
Like 30 seconds of it, and then we can
move on.
Yeah. So is it time for new recommendations?
Yeah. Cool thing. What's your cool thing?
So I'm so split between two that I really don't know that I can pick.
I mean, if you want to do two, do two.
Okay. So I have one that is a stand-up comedy special and one that is a psychological horror film.
All right.
The stand-up comedy special is called Stand Up for Drummers. It's by Fred Armisen. It is on Netflix. Check that shit out. He only let people who could impressively drum on a snare pad into the special.
Hmm.
About 10 minutes of the special is so for drummers that if you're not into drumming, then it's not really gonna work for you. But the rest of it's music about music, or the rest of the jokes are music at large. And he does this bit where he goes on a tour of the United States. He does every accent regionally, state by state, region by region. Like, I'm going to do all 5 different New York accents, like switching between them.
Wow.
With like multiple, like no time in between. The most impressive show of dialect I've ever seen.
That's hard.
Yeah. The other one is called Mom and Dad. It stars Nicolas Cage.
Oh boy.
In the role where he actually fits better than anything I've ever seen him in. Here's the concept. There's a signal that goes out. When it gets in your brain, it makes you want to murder your children. No one else, just your children.
Hmm.
So, the family that actually makes up the main plot is a teenage girl, she's like 15 or 16, a boy who's like 8 years old, and then Mom and Dad, played by Nick Cage and Selma Blair.
Oh.
They decide they're going to kill their kids, and Nicolas Cage is just unhinged enough to sell you as a guy who's going to murder his children.
That sounds ridiculous, and I want to watch it.
It's amazing. It's an Amazon original movie. Unfortunately, you do have to rent it from them, but it is worth the $6. It is so bonkers. And you actually get to see... I mean, it's like a gothic tale told from 2018. Everything is so modern that it's a critique on modern society.
How modern is it? Sorry.
You know, it's a critique on modern society in the classic horror film way of critiquing society.
Okay.
So, check either of those out if you're into comedy or psychological horror.
Which have a lot to do with each other, actually.
They do.
Like, they're both aiming for a sub-intellectual visceral response, so...
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And both of them are approached intellectually anyway. Yeah. So there's that.
Nicolas Cage does both at the same time frequently.
Yeah.
Okay. You did two things, so I'm going to do two things. One is I played a video game that we had talked about a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember. It was at a D&D session with like Ross and Ian, and like all three of y'all were like, "Oh no, that's good." So I found it on sale, and I bought it, and I played the first season of Telltale's The Wolf Among Us.
Oh, yes.
Which is based on a comic book series, like Telltale does.
Fables.
Fables by Bill Willingham, which I have read a fair amount of, not all of, but like my old roommate Rusty had a bunch of it. So, like, kind of familiar with the concept, which I think did help a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic premise of it is, all the characters from, like, fairy stories and shit are real and living in or near New York in kind of a little sequestered community. The sheriff is the big bad wolf, Big B Wolf, which is just such... I love how he did that.
Delightful.
And you are playing as Big B and basically have to solve a murder that happens. Like, a fable is killed and it sets off a sequence of events that is really fascinating. I like the format of it, like, that it's done in episodes. The only other game I've played like that heretofore thus far is Life is Strange, which I also really liked and would recommend. And it's kind of similar to that. It's like you're watching each of these episodes, which take maybe about an hour and a half, 2 hours to play. It's five episodes long, so it's not that long a game. And basically you're offered choices of, like, dialogue, or, like, you have to respond to certain actions by, like, pressing certain buttons according to cues on the screen. Like, it's a simple mechanic interactively, but it's interesting to watch. I did end up, like, I don't know. I'm very curious. I want to play it again because I'm very curious to see, like, how much certain choices impact the narrative. Because, like, I played it, you know, like it were me making these decisions. Like, what am I what is the reaction that I want to have to this situation?
Sure.
As opposed to, like, playing in a particular character. But, like, there's certain things that's, like, I want to go back and, like, do that differently and see what happens. But it's also apparently timely because, like, I guess not too long ago they announced Season 2 is going to come out sometime this year.
So. Yes.
So that's pretty cool.
On its way.
The other thing is a TV show that is currently airing, so it's not done yet, and that is American Crime Story: The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Specifically, I want to recommend Darren Criss in American Crime Story: The Assassination of Gianni Versace, because this kid is fucking killing it. Pun intended. I guess he's, like, big from Glee. I don't know. I didn't watch Glee. It's not my thing. I'm not gonna enjoy it, so I'm not gonna try, you know? Like, musical theater's fine. It's a thing. Some of it is great. Like, I like Avenue Q. There are other musicals I like, but it's not my jam. But I do know him from a Harry Potter musical, which... I don't know if you've seen this, but it's a college production. I want to say University of Michigan or something like that. I'm not certain. That's a musical theater parody of Harry Potter, and he's Harry Potter in it. I'm pretty sure you can find it on YouTube. But, like, there's... What I love about it is that it's, like, very low budget, but there's clearly a lot of thought and talent involved, and, like, seeing this guy do something that is very different, like, he's definitely a big part of that talent. And then, so, like, he's in it. Ricky Martin is in it, which was out of left field. Like, the whole first episode, I was like, who is that guy? I know that guy. I've seen that guy somewhere. And then I looked it up, and I was like, holy fucking shit, it's Ricky Martin.
That's a name I haven't heard in a while.
Right? Like, he kind of disappeared for a while, and now he's playing Gianni Versace's lover. Penelope Cruz is in it. I don't know off the top of my head the name of the guy who plays Versace. She's Donatella Versace. I don't know off the top of my head the name of the guy who plays Gianni Versace, but he's doing really good. Like... The acting is all really interesting, and the way the narrative is handled is also really interesting. Like, it basically, like, starts with the assassination, and then moves backwards through, like, Andrew Cunanan's serial killing career, and then what was before that. I think it's five episodes in now, so, like, maybe about halfway done-ish, but it's some of the most interesting recent television that I've seen.
Where does that air?
Ugh. I watch it online, so I'm not 100% sure. Give me just a second. I want to say, like, FX or something.
So I really enjoyed the first American Crime Story.
Yeah, the OJ one was really good. And this is as good. It might even be better. And yes, it is FX.
Cool.
So, okay. Well, that puts us right on time target, actually. We're about an hour in. So
excellent. What's our topic for next week?
I don't know. I have somewhere in this room. I don't know where I put it. Somewhere I have a list of show ideas. But let's see. What do we want to do? We could do... Actually, one of the things that was on the list that kind of comes back to that comedy horror thing is like, what's a piece of art that has elicited a visceral physical response? And like, how did it do that?
Yeah.
So that could be an interesting one.
Definitely. Sounds good to me.
Yeah. All right. Well, stick around for that if you're listening. Again, not sure when this is going to be up. Hopefully by next week we will have a name for the show.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like that should be a priority. Yeah, any final thoughts?
Nope.
Okay. Well, see you later.
See you next time.